Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey folks, I'm Alex Dowd.
And I'm Katie Rife.
We're now entering the final month of the unlikely summer movie season of 2021. And against all odds, Hollywood is back with some films that might actually be worth your attention. On this week's episode, Katie and I are diving into three new films coming soon or now showing in a theater near you. M. Night Shyamalan's new thriller, Old, David Lowery's take on the King Arthur tales, The Green Knight, and James Gunn's reinvention of the R-rated superhero movie, The Suicide Squad.
Welcome to Film Club.
Okay, Katie, so you and I doing this job, I feel like there's one thing that that comes up sometimes when people are angry at us about a review or okay. When we've panned some movie or something. And it's something that that I hear a lot. I don't know if you hear it too, but it's some version of why would you choose to be a film critic when you clearly don't like movies?
Oh, yes.
You know,
this is a popular saw. Yeah, the idea that critics just crap all over everything. And, you know, it's really not true. I mean, if you hated movies, this would be the absolute worst job for you because all you do is watch movies all the time.
Well, right, exactly. You know, and and I'll admit that I mean, another variation on that I get sometimes is somebody saying, man, you just really wanted to dislike this or you went into this hoping to hate it. And I mean, we would have to be total psychopath to want to do this job and dislike the movies that we're going to see, you know?
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, it's just that you see a lot. This is what I'll kind of try to convey to people, is that you watch a lot of movies when you're a film critic. And so you have, like, a pretty good barometer for what is good and what isn't, simply because you have a good knowledge of the range of what's out there. And that makes it easier for you to pick out what's on the top and also what's on the bottom. So, like, no, you didn't want to hate Space Jam 2. It's just that you've seen 100 movies already this year and it was towards the bottom. You know, that's all it is.
Yeah, yeah. I think that our sensibilities are certainly shaped by the sheer volume of what we watch, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think that critics are sometimes less willing than a general audience to just go with the flow. I mean, if you're a person who goes to the movies a few times a year and you go see a film in theaters, and if it does the job that it's setting out to do and you find it diverting enough, you might be inclined, I think, as a person to say, yeah, that was fine. That did what it wanted to do. I had a good time in the movies. Because of the amount that we watch, I think that those standards are a little bit different for us. And I'm not saying that we're right and everyone else is wrong. By no means am I saying that. I'm only saying that I think that our perspective is often shaped by the amount that we see. And I actually have a friend who's convinced that I'm actually easier on a lot of movies because of everything that I see.
Interesting.
That there are movies that he would deem really bad that I'm like, no, that actually had some redeeming facets to it. And he's like, the only reason you're focusing on those is because it's almost like a survival mechanism for you, is that you are finding things to like sometimes. And also the volume of pure garbage that you watch is much
exactly.
higher than me, you know?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And it's funny, you know, people who hardly ever go to the movies. I have a friend who only goes and sees movies with me. The last film she had seen in the theater was Midsommar with me because I told her that she would like it. And then we went and saw Zola last weekend and she was like, I think I saw like maybe one new movie in there. I was like, but the thing is, you know, she's very critical of the movies she goes and sees.
Yeah.
So I think maybe it's the opposite of what you were saying about not, you know, being more willing to go with the flow. At least
yeah,
this person is.
I mean, yeah, maybe there's another side to it too, which is that I feel like sometimes when it, like when an audience really turns on something, and you could feel that sometimes in a movie theater when an audience is like, this did not deliver what I wanted from it. There's a different buy-in. You know, we go see a bad movie. You and I go see a bad or a mediocre movie. It's, you know, it's all part of the job. It's just business, you know. We're like, okay, well, that one was bad. If you, let's say you paid money for a babysitter, you went out, you paid for rising ticket prices, you know, maybe you paid up to $40 for the for you and whoever you're with to see this movie or something, and it really does disappoint you, you are going to go hard on it, I think, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, particularly with the babysitter thing and, you know, with the, well, I mean, yeah, I don't know, particularly the babysitter thing, I think I understand why people don't want to be led astray. And you know what? What's interesting about that is sometimes when I am recommending a movie that maybe is a little bit more difficult, you know, the kind of thing I do appreciate as a critic because it's different. Sometimes I feel as if I should say in the review, like, don't make this the one movie that you're going to go see in the theater this year because you probably won't like it. Because I've had people say to me before, like, yeah, I read your review and you were really enthusiastic on this movie and I hated it. I didn't get it at all. And I was like, I mean, sorry, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's
it was cool.
I read somewhere, and I wish I could remember exactly where this was. It was a piece about Groundhog Day, actually. And it came up – it was presenting this idea that I had never heard before but that I think about sometimes, which is that there are 7 o'clock movies and there are 9 o'clock movies. And the notion is that a 9 o'clock movie is a movie that you watch maybe right before you go to bed. Maybe it's in the theater. Maybe it's at home. You watch it, and then you immediately afterwards you can just go to bed and go to sleep. It's something that very digestible. A 7 o'clock movie is one where afterwards you want to have a little bit of time to think about it, to talk about it. A movie that might actually engage you in a way that's more than just here's this thing that can pass before my eyes and then I go to sleep. So I think what you're kind of getting at least partially at the idea is that sometimes when you're recommending a 7 o'clock movie, you want people to know that this is not something that that's just going to be pure escapism. It might actually ask a little bit more of you.
Yeah, it's a 7 o'clock movie. Yeah, or maybe like I'm thinking about, you know, the best films of the year so far that we didn't review. I recommend a movie called I Blame Society that I think is really funny and sharp. And I have seen a couple of movies this year that I thought about I Blame Society all the way through them because it kind of like puts a needle in the balloon of like, you know, Hollywood narcissism and the idea of writing a screenplay about your own life. And then you watch other movies that are that and you just can't help but chuckle. But, you know, it's like it's kind of a rough movie. It's very low budget and the main character's really fucked up. And, you know, that's something that I often kind of struggle with is how do you – I'm not saying don't see it, but I don't – it's a specific type of person who will want to see this. You know what I mean?
I think you just kind of have to prepare people for what they're getting into.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what it is because I think that you're right that there's an audience that might appreciate this. I think it's just good to tell people sometimes what they're getting into without necessarily, you know, giving away all of a film's surprises or even – I mean, one of the tricky things is that sometimes one of the coolest things a movie can do is subvert your expectations. Mm. And so I kind of go both ways on that where it's like – as a critic, I a part of me wants to let people know that this is not necessarily what they might think it is from the trailers or going into it. So be ready for something that's going to be a little different than what you're expecting. At the same time, there's another part of me that says by even saying that, by even telling a reader that, am I spoiling the pleasure of discovering that something is radically different than they thought it was going to be? You know?
Yeah, that's super interesting. And I think in some ways that kind of applies to the first movie that we were going to talk about today, which is Old, because this film, in a lot of ways it is a Hollywood movie. It is a Hollywood movie, not in a lot of ways. It just is a Hollywood movie. But the way that this movie is shot and the way that it approaches dialogue are so different.
Yeah.
It's so idiosyncratic that I could very much... I'm going to be honest with you. not all of it really, like, I admired what it was doing and I saw what it was doing, but I didn't find all of it all that enjoyable to watch. And I think I might be a little bit in the minority on this movie.
So you mean purely as a visual experience?
Yeah, purely as a visual experience. There were times where I found it disorienting in an unpleasant way.
Well, I might suggest that that's very intentional and, you know, that this is very much a, the film is about a disorienting experience for everybody in the movie as well. That I think that this might be a case where M. Night Shyamalan, the director, is intentionally trying to make us feel a little queasy.
Yeah. And, you know, and I mean, that kind of applies to what we're talking about, where you're kind of letting people know going in that, like, listen, this isn't necessarily going to be the most digestible experience.
For sure. We talked last week about M. Night Shyamalan in general. We talked about his whole career. We did an overview. So if you're interested in Shyamalan and you want to hear our thoughts on that, we have a good hour and 15-minute talk about that last week's episode. We were not able to talk about Old during that discussion because we recorded before we were able to see the movie, but we have seen it now. And I think it would have been an interesting addition to that discussion because I think in some ways it really does capture some of what we were talking about. One of the things that came up last week during the conversation was that Shyamalan's grasp of the way that people talk is sometimes a little shaky.
It's odd. It's weird.
I mean, he sort of prefers watching this. I had the conversation that we had in my mind while I was watching it. Even I was just thinking about the ways in which the dialogue in this film is very strange. And I think that he has a way of sometimes writing characters that state very bluntly what they're going through emotionally. There's a lot of emotional declaration. Mm-hmm. But I also think sometimes his attempts at banter really do sound like space aliens trying to sound like people, you know?
Yeah. Oh, very, very much so. And that's another one of the elements of this film that I think that you can really get into the groove with or just find wildly off-putting.
Right. I got into the groove with it, to be honest, because I think that this movie operates in a kind of nightmare state.
I'd agree with that.
There's a real, like, nightmare logic to the way this thing unfolds. And to me, the slightly tinnier dialogue that Shyamalan is one might say infamous for at this point in his career, I think it really contributes to that vibe in a lot of ways. I kind of went with it. Now that might be me sort of making excuses for a filmmaker who I find pretty interesting across the board. But in this case, I really do think it works in the context of what the film is doing.
Well, I would add to that, let's first off say the premise of the movie is pretty straightforward. It's kind of a high concept sci-fi fantasy kind of thing where basically we open with this family going to a beach resort, and then the concierge, I'm skipping over a lot of the backstory in the beginning, you know, they have family dynamics, the parents are separating, which is kind of a stock plot point in M. Night Shyamalan movies at this point.
We should mention they're played by Vicky Creeps and Gael Garcia Bernal. They're the parents.
Indeed. And so the concierge of their hotel says, whenever the concierge of your hotel says to you, I don't tell everyone about this, that's a lie. They've told everyone about it. It's not really a secret. They're just trying to make you feel special. But in this case, they really do target certain guests at this hotel to go to this private beach. And on the private beach, as they discover after they hang out for a little bit, time moves very differently than it does everywhere else in the world. It moves much faster. Do you remember the exact formula? I think it was like 2 years every half an hour or something
like
that?
It's 1 year every half an hour.
Okay.
Yeah. So
2 years every hour you age.
Yeah. So, you know, we have this group of, we have this family. We have this, the mother, father, and their two children, who I believe are 6 and 11 at the beginning of the film. And they show up on the beach, and then there's a group of other guests at the hotel, this kind of squabbling ensemble that Shyamalan builds.
Mm-hmm.
And, the difference, how quickly they're aging is something that the parents notice more quickly. When they see that their kids are a lot older, it's less noticeable with adults because obviously the effects of aging slow down a little bit as you get older. You know, there's a big difference mm-hmm. between somebody aging from 6 to 8 and somebody aging from 42 to 44, for example.
Exactly.
but it becomes clear to them very quickly that they are all aging very, very fast, and that over the course of a single day, they will basically have lived their entire life. Nightmarish premise, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really frightening idea. And I think that Shyamalan is a father of three. And he's now, I believe he turns 51 this year. He's somebody who is presumably, like all of us, is dealing with acknowledging his own mortality. And also, as a father, is probably acknowledging how quickly his children grow up. To me, old feels very much like a sort of fantastical nightmare version of that old saying, they grow up so fast. I think it's very much about parents looking, about that cognitive dissonance that parents feel sometimes when they see their kid and their kid is suddenly a teenager and they don't realize where those years went, you know?
Yeah, our colleague Matt Shimkowitz wrote a short piece about this too, and I agree with both you guys. I think this movie is really more about parenting than it is about aging.
Mm-hmm. I think that's I think it's about both, honestly, but I do think that's a big element of it, because I think a lot of it really is about the perspective of the parents, and there is a frankly very unnerving, I would go as far to say nightmarish sequence in the film that I actually don't want to disclose what happens in it. But
let's not say beyond the main premise, except I think it's okay to address the biggest question, which is, why don't they just leave the beach?
Yeah.
They can't.
They can't.
They can't.
Yeah. There is something keeping them there. And actually, I mean, I would say this movie almost goes too far at times in addressing questions the audience might have about its premise, because the movie is...
Because M. Night Shyamalan being a little bit defensive because people like to pick apart his
plots. Yeah, it might be. I do feel like he's always... I mean, we talked last week when we were talking about Shyamalan about the fact that I think that The Sixth Sense is mostly airtight, but that people kind of... sometimes when people are being really... when people are being really nitpicky about it, they talk about how certain behavior in it doesn't make a ton of sense. I've always disagreed with that criticism. But in this case, yes, it might be Shyamalan sort of playing defense in that respect and making sure that people can't be like – because, I mean, there's explanations. People are like, why are hair and fingernails not growing really fast? And they have an explanation for that, and they have an explanation for why people have – clothes that they're not growing out of. That they have changes of clothes when they start growing out of them.
Sure.
You know, it's a movie that does try to, almost to a fault, I would say, try to give this some degree of rational sense, this nightmarish premise. I actually think one of my biggest beefs with the film, which I overall quite liked, is that I feel like the ending of this movie, the last act of this movie, kind of lets it down in the sense that it... it goes into highly expository mode.
Yeah, it does.
You know, and it's very rational in its final stretch and says we need some sort of big explanation for this. And I didn't require that. I don't know about you.
No, I don't require that. If it's a good enough premise and it plays out in a suitably nightmare logic kind of way, I don't particularly need a big explanation. Well, what I was going to say is that this film, like we were saying, it has kind of a lot of your signature M. Night Shyamalan tropes in it, both in terms of content and filmmaking. And one area of content that I thought this particular film fit really well with is there's a lot of precocious kids who talk like adults in M. Night Shyamalan movies. And I think that worked really well with this premise.
It does, actually. I didn't think about that. But, I mean, you know, they are literally children who are becoming adults, you know, as we watch them, you know. So that you're right. That does make a lot of sense, because that has been kind of a hallmark of his work going back to Wide Awake, to his second feature. Yeah.
But I think on the whole, for me, I think I respected this movie more than I actually enjoyed watching it. Mm. And I agree with you that I think that might have been intentional. But in the end, I didn't think I hooked into it the same way you did. So, yeah, I think, like I said, in the end, I respected it more than I enjoyed watching it.
Got it. Old is now in theaters. You can see that if you want. I imagine that it'll be available on streaming before for too long if you're not looking mm-hmm. to make it out to the theaters just yet. I don't know how the film did this weekend.
It was number one.
Oh, well, that's great. I guess that makes sense. Again, I mean, we discussed this in the Shyamalan episode last week. People have this perception of him as somebody who's constantly churning out flops when the reality is that Shyamalan has made a lot of hits in his career. People keep going seeing his movies, even if they make fun of them afterwards or before. He is somebody who is a reliable hit maker, you know? I was happy to see that. I'm very happy to learn this one did well. I think it's a very interesting film and one that got under my skin a little bit, even if there are moments in it that are goofy in that very signature Shyamalan way. So if you are looking to go to the movie theaters this weekend, there is another film out that I would dare to say is also a visual experience. And it's one of the first mm-hmm. movies that basically had to move its release date because of the pandemic. And that is David Lowery's The Green Knight.
And they moved it in the UK, too. It's not opening in the UK next week like it was supposed to, which is too bad.
It is too bad because, honestly, here's my thought about this, which is that, you know, when the Green Knight was supposed to open in May of last year, obviously that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were very excited for this film, especially when they saw the first teaser. And there was a lot of talk online, a lot of people sort of demanding, when is A24 going to make this thing available? I want to see it now. And it was, you know, for a very long time, The Green Knight was just new release date to be determined. And it's arriving now more than a year after it was originally scheduled. And having now seen the film, though, I can understand why A24 was not so eager to just drop this thing onto a streaming platform sometime over the past year. This is a movie that truly benefits from being seen on a big screen, I think.
I think so. And also, I understand why they didn't want to dump it onto streaming platforms is because a lot of it is kind of dimly lit and television calibrations. That looks like shit a lot of the time on TVs. And so I think for that reason alone, it's worth saving for theaters. Like, it is visually very beautiful, like you're saying. And I would love to talk more about that. But also, I think it's kind of shadowy, you know, like it's set in the past. And I'm not sure if they lit the scenes with candlelight, but it looks like it. And yeah, I could see this looking like crap on a TV.
I could see that too. Although I could also see it looking like crap in some theaters. I mean, there's a larger discussion to be had about movie theaters basically turning their bulbs at a lower setting in order to preserve them for longer. That's apparently a real problem in multiplexes around the country, which is that you go see a movie and the light the bulb itself is not up to its highest setting because they're trying to preserve. They're basically trying to preserve that bulb for longer and save money, and it results in movies that look that don't look like they're supposed to look.
If you have a reliable art house you can see this at, I would encourage you to do that because, if it was calibrated wrong, you would lose a lot of it from this movie.
And it is really, truly a spectacular visual experience, I think, you know?
And, oh, my God.
You know, and beyond that, though, I think that and I feel this way about most movies, to be honest, and we've talked about this before, is that the movie theater is, for a lot of movies, is the ideal place to see it, I think partially because it creates the expectation of an unbroken experience. You know, the idea is that you sit down in that theater and it's you in the movie, basically. And obviously that's an ideal that isn't always upheld by the realities of seeing a movie in public with people who don't always respect the sanctity of the movie theater and don't respect those around them. There are distractions. But I think that the fact of the matter is the fact that you cannot pause a movie when you're seeing it on the big screen. I think that is a big part of preserving the continuity of an experience that is meant to start at a time and end at another time with no interruptions. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. And I think this film is especially like that. I think that this film, this film deals a lot with magic and with fantasy. And there's really kind of a spellbound kind of aura over this movie where you really feel like you're getting caught up in like someone telling a story, you know, that like whole storyteller around the fire kind of folklore vibe is very much in this. And it's got this ethereal magic kind of nature magic pagan quality to it that's really enchanting. And so, this movie really needs what you're talking about, which is just letting yourself kind of be taken into the experience.
That's a really good point. It really does have that vibe of being told, you're being told a story, you know, gather around the flame, sort of, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of flame imagery in this film, too, as well, I should mention.
Yeah.
It's for those who don't know, the Green Knight is based on, it's written and directed by David Lowery, a Texas filmmaker who, he made The Old Man and the Gun, he made A Ghost Story, he made Eight and Body Saints, the Disney remake of Pete's Dragon, which I have to say is the one Disney remake that I will give a pass to, I think.
He's one of the few to come out of the Disney system and go back to making indies, too.
That's true. It's remarkable. He actually went and made small films again after making a giant budget Disney yep. film. So kudos to him for that, if nothing else. in this case, what he's tackling is a very old story from the 14th century. It's one of the better known of the Arthurian tales, the stories of King Arthur and the Round Table, obviously. It's an epic poem that was written in the 14th century. It's the author of the poem is still unknown centuries later. There are theories about that, but as of now, it is still very much anonymous. This is a piece of writing that people have been studying for ages. It's sort of the cornerstone of a lot of curriculums talking about English literature. And I feel like over the years, it has inspired countless conversations about its symbolism and about there are numerous interpretations of this text. It's very much one of them, obviously, being that it's very much about Christianity versus a more pagan faith. And I feel like Lowery largely looks at this story and sees it as a symbolic text. I think he's interested in the meaning behind its tropes and its motifs.
Yes, absolutely. This is definitely what you would call a rich text with a lot that you could pull out of it. And there's a few different threads. You know, another thread in it is there's different acts. You know, there's different stages in Sir Garwin's journey. And each of those steps represents a different virtue and chivalry. And so there's a lot of different ways you can look at this story. But I agree that Lowery tells it mostly as sort of a spiritual, folkloric kind of tale.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's interested in the kind of mystery of this
mysticism.
Mysticism
is a word I would definitely use.
And, I mean, you know, we've seen lots of King Arthur stories have been brought to the screen. I think most recently in Hollywood, we had the Guy Ritchie version, which basically turned the King Arthur story into a lads chatting British crime movie, but with fantasy shit in it too, you know, but in the past. Yeah. Which I have to admit that has its charms too, to be honest. I actually did kind of enjoy that film. But Lowery is not interested in The Green Knight as a piece of action adventure, as something that he can turn into an action adventure movie. This is not an action adventure film.
No, it's a fantasy film.
Mm-hmm. And I think a mood piece amazing. Too, right?
Mm. Yes, very much a mood piece. There's you know, you talked about the visual aspect of it and there's a lot of texture. I really love the texture of all the castles and the costumes mm-hmm. and all that kind of thing. But I think that there's a lot of atmosphere in it, too. There's a lot of kind of foggy atmosphere, a lot of colored fog, a lot of there's a sequence, you know, with like a ghostly maiden in a white nightgown diving into a pond and all these kind of all this really resonant imagery that he really latches onto. And I think that the tone of the film matches that in a way that I found really cool and interesting.
I have to admit, there were times that I found the tone a little monolithic.
Yeah.
You know, like it definitely hits that A24 dread button very hard throughout,
mm-hmm.
you know, one thing I did definitely appreciate about it though, is that it comes from such a rich text and there's so much you can extrapolate from its scenes. I do think that Lowery is very interested in The Green Knight as a source of very ripe symbolism. So you can sort of chase various lines of interpretation in this film and say, I want to think about this as a piece about sexuality. I want to think about this as a piece about religion. There are a lot of different sort of paths you can take watching this if you want to do the interpretive work. But at the same time, it's also such a rich piece of visual storytelling that you can kind of just let it wash over you too.
But you felt like the tone of it was like too heavy, like too maybe laden with its own self importance. Like, what about the tone didn't quite work for you?
A little bit. I think that kind of captures it in a sense. I think it's very portentous, you know, for it for pretty much its entire length. I mean, this is not a playful film, I'd say.
No.
It's a film that has a very it's sullen in some ways, I think, too. It sort of takes the Arthur legend, the legends of King Arthur, and sort of says, can we make this into something that has a real sense of spiritual heft to it? And I think I simultaneously admire that. And also there were times towards the end where I felt like it was kind of hitting that same note over and over again, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is not a you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll cheer type of movie. It's very consistent with its sort of campfire, I don't know how to describe it.
It kind of strikes a mood of woozy astonishment very early on and sticks to that.
That's a good way to put it. You know? I was just kind of throwing words out like ethereal, mystical, somber. Dark, like you're just throwing out all these adjectives. So.
Well, there's a sequence in the film where the main character, played by Dev Patel, where he eats some mushrooms, and the movie is a little ambiguous about whether what happens next is a vision brought on by the mushrooms or if he's really experiencing it. The thing about it is that this character exists in a world where there are real supernatural elements. So I think sort of trying to draw the line between what's real and what's happening in this character's mind is kind of a fool's errand.
I don't think it really matters.
It doesn't really matter. I don't think it really matters. Yeah. But I remember thinking after that like the whole movie kind of feels like a mushroom trip in some sense, in that it's just like, you know, you've sort of consumed this substance and you're just being bombarded with this hypnotic imagery, you know?
What did you think about Dev Patel in the title role?
Well, I think,
or not the title role. Oh my gosh!
Well, in a way, I think it is the title role as well. I think there's a dual meaning to the title. I mean, we should, in terms of just giving a quick outline of what the plot is, for those who have not read those who do not remember their days in high school reading this story or didn't read it in high school. Dev Patel plays Gawain. He is the nephew of King Arthur. The film more or less opens with him he's in Camelot and he goes and he's around the round table with the knights and with King Arthur, and he's talking about how he feels as though he has not had any real experiences in life. He's very young. He's a teenager, I think, that they suggest. And while they're eating during the feast, this mysterious green knight walks in through the front door, and he basically says, I come here with a game and a challenge. One of you should try to land a blow on me, basically. And once you have landed that blow, I will return it in kind in a year. So Patel's Gawain gets in the ring with him, ends up cutting off his head, decapitating him. The Green Knight, who is a figure of he's not human. That's very clear. He's a kind of sort of a tree god, I think, is kind of how they.
Yeah, he's kind of a nature spirit kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
This movie has an animus streak to it.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, and that's an addition by Lowry too. I mean, having in doing a little research before writing the review, and by the way, this is one chance where I remember saying, as we left the movie, I remember saying, I really would wish that I had a little bit more time with this one and that I could actually see it again before writing about it, because there's just so much going on in the sort of the cracks and crevices of this movie. Having looked at a few translations and at the original text, the manuscript is out there, you can see it, they describe him in the text as just green, basically. There's not a lot more description than that. He just his skin is green, his beard is green, he's green, wears green clothes. in the movie, they sort of envision the Green Knight as this, I mean, he's sort of like a walking tree almost. He's like a man made of a vegetable, you know?
Something that I think is interesting about the Green Knight and the way that Lowry's kind of underlining the religious spiritual aspect of this story is that in like contemporary, I mean, you know, contemporary Wicca is different from like a lot of it's modern, a lot of it's made up in the 20th century. But they, one of their gods is called the Green Man. Mm-hmm. And when you look at like drawings of the Green Man, he looks a lot like the Green Knight in this movie. So I think that that's kind of interesting.
Willing to bet that might be an influence on his design a little bit in the film. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he, in any case, they end up sparring. He cuts off his head. The knight sort of picks up his head and says, in a year, come find me and I'm going to deliver that blow back on you. And so the film becomes this episodic adventure where Patel's character basically has to go find the knight, and he's has a lot of hesitation and fear about it because, well, you know, I mean, who wants to get their head chopped off, you know? But I think the title, by shortening the title, I think Lowry is meaning for us to read it another way, that the Green Knight in question is also Gawain himself. He is somebody who is a young man who does not know a lot about the world and somebody who does not have a lot of experience. And the movie is, I think if you look at this movie, if you try to find a dramatic through line for this film, I think it is 100% about somebody who is kind of blanching at the responsibilities and the consequences of adulthood in some ways.
Yeah, he wants the fame and the honor and the reputation, but he doesn't want to do any of the work that goes into that. And also, I mean, so what we've kind of been talking about but haven't said directly is that you can see the Green Knight as the literal Green Knight, or Sir Gawain is green in that he's like naive.
Yep.
And throughout the narrative, as he goes out on his quest, he meets all these different people who kind of show him the different ways that a naive person can get taken advantage of, particularly in like the Middle Ages. You know, it was traveler beware back then.
yeah. So, I mean, you asked me if how I felt about Patel in the role. I think he's good. I think this is not a movie that. Well, I think there are a lot of fine actors in this film, including Alicia Vikander and Joel Edgerton. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the human figures in this are necessarily the star of this film. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I would agree that this is a film that is vibes first.
Very much. Vibes first.
Performances and text second.
Yeah. But I do think that Patel he's an intensely likable actor. And I think that over the years, he's played a lot of plucky young men with big dreams who want more out of life, you know. So he brings those associations with him as well. So he kind of – Patel being in the role, I think, creates a shorthand for this character that the movie doesn't – I mean, the movie doesn't give us a ton of backstory about him. The movie doesn't belabor a lot of aspects of his character. We kind of meet him, and then he's on his way, more or less. And I think that the shorthand that Patel provides us – as an actor, you know, our associations that we bring to him already, I think, help. They also help, I think, in getting us to care about a character who I think the movie is often I think this is a movie that often is focusing in a somewhat subversive way around the ways that that Gawain does not live up, at least at this stage in his life, to the virtues of the supposed of the Round Table and the King Arthur way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, completely. And I think that's another of, I wouldn't precisely call this a coming of age tale, but I think it is kind of a fable about responsibility and backing up your kind of words with deeds and how that is part of maturity.
Yeah, very much so. And I think that comes through a lot in the final act of this film, which again, we won't talk about, but I think this makes it an exceptionally interesting choice towards its conclusion that I almost wish we could talk more about, because I think that it borrows from a film I won't name, but I think it borrows from it in a really productive way. And I don't know about you, but I thought this really stuck the landing.
I thought so too. And interestingly, I think the sequence that we're both talking about is not in the poem.
Right.
So it was an addition by Lowry.
Yep.
I thought overall this was just like a really, really rich film with a lot to look at and a lot to think about. And, you know, a lot of these sort of building block elements, you know, like the cast and the story are secondary to it being being a folktale, you know, with a moral message and lots of cool, creepy, mystical imagery along the way.
I frankly can't wait to see it again, honestly. And I do genuinely wish I could have seen it again before writing about it. This is one of those cases where I imagine I'm going to look back on what I wrote about it this week and think, oh, Jesus, I should have definitely should have seen this again before writing about it. This doesn't even really scratch the surface of this film, you know?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I mean, the rest of the year is still coming, but I have a feeling that people are going to be talking about this one when we get to the end of the year, too.
Yeah, for sure.
So The Green Knight is a movie that I have been anticipating for a really long time and kind of had a feeling that I would like. You know what movie took me by surprise is The Suicide Squad. I was not expecting to like this movie as much as I did.
No, I'm actually kind of frankly shocked at how much I enjoyed this film.
Yeah?
Yeah, this is kind of the DCEU movie I've been waiting for the whole time.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, I think it's the first movie in this franchise that I think really actually kind of knocks it out of the park, you know?
Yeah, like, well, I mean, what's interesting to me about the DCEU is that they do kind of leave room for different directors' kind of visions. And, you know, in terms of knocking it out of the park, I think this one does just because it is writer-director James Gunn, who did the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, is doing this one. And it is an R-rated Suicide Squad, unlike the previous one, the 2016 Suicide Squad, which was PG-13. And to me, what I think is good about it is just like James Gunn being himself, like his purest self. In a lot of ways, it kind of goes back to the trauma movies that he came up on, which are just like these proudly juvenile, kind of ultra-violent, sloppy, jokey, you know, those are sci-fi movies.
Yeah, Gunn, for those who don't know, got his start in Troma, the famous exploitation film company that made The Toxic Avenger, among other disgusting cult classics. And yeah, he really does kind of get back into his roots here. I mean, I feel like this is one of the stronger statements I will make on today's episode, honestly.
Oh, wow.
But to me, this movie feels more intrinsically like a James Gunn film than the Guardians films do. Because in some ways, I feel like everyone talks about how DC, in some ways, that DC gives its filmmakers greater advantage to supposedly put their mark on the material than Marvel does. And,
right.
And I think that is one of the ways in which the DC films are potentially more interesting than the Marvel ones. I found myself watching this and thinking that this is almost a refinement of Guardians in the sense that it is Gunn really putting his auteuristic mark on superhero material, in part by occasionally being very gory. The humor in this is grotesque and madcap. You can really see the trauma influence in a way that you in the Guardians films. To me, as much as I think those films more or less work for what they're trying to do,
yeah, I enjoy
those
them.
Movies do feel a little bit like somebody who has a slightly more dangerous sensibility being tamed for the sake of a giant corporate,
right? Like being respectable.
Being respectable, yes. And he gets to be a lot less disreputable in this one, I think, you know?
Yeah, it's so funny when you use the word refined. I kind of chuckled to myself because this movie is like you said, it's very, very violent, very gory. One of the opening sequences is just there, sort of a Vietnam style storming of a tropical beach, and there's just people exploding left and right, and there's a big dramatic death that's played as like a sick joke within the first 5 minutes of the movie. And yeah, the humor is very, the word I'd use is like vulgar, but it's really fun though. You know, it's not like that in your face, I'm going to be anti-PC kind of juvenile or vulgar or silly. It's just giddy. Like this movie, I'm working on the review. It'll be out by the time we play this episode. And I compare this movie to doing whippets in a parking lot in the in the review. And I don't think that that's inaccurate.
Katie, it's honestly hard for me to think of it. I don't want to oversell this thing. I think it still is. It is essentially a modern superhero movie with a with a enormous amount of CGI, for example. And
yes,
I think you could nitpick certain aspects of it. But I do think that it's more fun. Yeah, I mean, I think there's the giddiness is a good thing to point out, because I do think that there is a sense of play in this film that I do not get in a lot of the modern superhero movies. That feel sort of, there's a certain sense of obligation about a lot of them. They're like, we're just moving this thing forward. And this thing is obviously, I mean, this movie is part of a larger franchise plan in a vague sense. It is certainly,
yeah.
I mean, there are characters, obviously Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn is in the film as well. There are a few other characters who appeared in the previous Suicide Squad film that are in this movie. But on a whole, this thing does not feel like it is attempting to continue someone else's story or set up another one. It really does feel like Gunn was given sort of the keys to the castle and said, do what you want to do with this thing. And he made something that's just sort of outrageously fun, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, when this film was announced, because Suicide Squad was only 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of talk of like, okay, so the Suicide Squad, what is it going to be? Is it a reboot? Is it a sequel? And I would think it's neither of those things, really. It's just like a chapter from the book of Suicide Squad. It could ostensibly take place after, I think it probably does take place after the events of the 2016 film. For example, you know, Harley Quinn isn't with the Joker anymore in this movie.
Right, and she knows Rick Flagg, the character played by Joel Kinnaman, who she meets in the first Suicide Squad movie.
Yeah, in that way, this movie really did remind me of a comic book series, in the sense that, you know, in comic books, you can have a larger continuity, but you can also have kind of a standalone series where you'll have a different artist or a writer kind of doing their take on a character or a group of characters, and it's kind of a standalone adventure. And in that way, this movie felt very comic booky to me. And another way it felt very comic booky to me is that it's colorful.
It is.
It does have a lot of that CGI that you were talking about, particularly towards the end. I think a modern superhero film will inevitably build to some sort of gigantic CGI set piece with many, many moving parts. Is kind of hard to follow.
Yeah.
But this one is colorful, and that wins it a lot of points with me, I could be honest.
Yeah, I mean, we won't say like what the third act of this film is, but I'll say this is one of the more fun giant CGI closing action sequences. I felt like I was seeing something I don't see in every single one of these, you know? To me, the title almost feels like a flex to me. Like, this is the Suicide Squad. This is the one you need to see. Because in a lot of respects, this does play like a do-over, at least to me. It feels like...
It does.
Because people, the premise itself is not unworkable, I think, as the film proves. I mean, I think that, you know, Ayer's Suicide Squad, which came out, as you said, 5 years ago, was not well received by critics. It made a boatload of money. But I think that the general consensus seems to be that it is towards the bottom, if not at the very bottom, of the DCEU. Like, if one were to make a ranking of these films, it would basically be at the bottom of that. And, you know, obviously, both films are working from this premise from the DC Comics universe, this notion that the U.S. government basically weaponizes supervillains who are incarcerated and who are in this maximum security prison, and says we will knock some time off your sentence or even commute your sentence if you agree to a highly dangerous mission that you may not survive. And that's kind of an irresistible premise, I think. Ayer's version from a few years ago made a total hash of it. And I think that it's interesting that Gunn got this gig, because in some ways, watching Ayer's Suicide Squad, you can definitely see that I honestly think it was DC explicitly trying to do Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, kind of aping his style. I mean, there are some things that, you know, both of these films have that, honestly, James Gunn does it better. It's kind of like, you know, after the last Suicide Squad. And there's sort of an interesting backstory to this movie also, where James Gunn was briefly fired from Disney for some old tweets that came up, and he apologized for him and all that stuff. He doesn't, you know, he dig his heels in and try to defend all that. But And there was, and the backstory of that was very complicated. I covered the story, and as it turned out, it was kind of a bad faith campaign that started on right-wing message boards and all this stuff. It was sort of, I, you know, this might not be entirely accurate, but I think it was kind of their attempt to manufacture a cancel culture controversy that they could then point to and be like, look, see, they canceled James Gunn. Yeah. But in the end, it didn't work. He made this movie, and he's going to make Guardians 3.
Right. He, like, went to the crosstown rival, said, well, I got fired, and they said, great, make a movie for us. And then Marvel came back and said, okay, never mind, make the third Guardians for us. So, yeah, Gunn ends up in not such a bad position at the end of this thing. So I don't want to talk too much about the plot of the film. I will say that this is a movie that has the courage of its convictions in terms of what this premise is. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say a whole lot more about that except to say that it's a very fatalistic corner of the DC universe. Gunn embraces... Gunn embraces the kind of the hilariously D-list villains he can bring in this installment. You know, he has a lot of fun with that. Just sort of paging through through DC Comics and finding these D-listers from the Rogues Gallery and bringing them in.
Which is great for me because Batman villains are my favorite. So
yeah, you know, 100%. Yeah. And he assembles a really strong cast, too, mm-hmm. I think, you know. I think that, the ensemble cast of this movie is enormous.
Oh, yeah.
And some of them don't have terribly large roles, but I think in terms of the principles, I mean, you have Idris Elba playing a character called Bloodsport, who is not radically different than the character that Will Smith played in Suicide Squad, mm-hmm. I think to the point where he actually was initially... I think there was talk that he was just being cast as that character, mm-hmm. and then they finally just decided, you know what, let's just make him a different character. But in terms of backstory and even power set, he's not radically different, you know.
Right, right. One of your master assassin guys, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. You have obviously Margot Robbie is reprising the role of Harley Quinn. And a character who I think has evolved some over the course of this franchise.
A lot. The difference between the Harley Quinn in 2016 and now is huge. And there was Birds of Prey in there. And then there's the animated series, which I have not watched, but it comes very highly recommended, which also is, you know, kind of colorful and a little bit irreverent.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So John Cena is in it as well. And
I think John Cena is really funny.
He's very funny.
Whenever I see him pop up in a movie, he's always funny, and his character in this one is great. He's playing a character called Peacemaker, who is, you know, a very, very upright, you know, defender of America kind of guy, but in this totally amoral way where, I forget, this is an exact quote, but he says something like, I don't care how many people I have to kill for freedom, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that is kind of a theme in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Is... you know, like the American government and how America likes to make itself out to be this force of good in the world when actually our hands are very, very dirty. And with that theme in mind, it's kind of hilarious. Early on in the movie, it starts with a shot of all the heroes, you know, marching out in front of an American flag in what a lot of superhero movies is a big patriotic moment. But when you look at it in the context of this movie, it is just completely spoofing that, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think this is a movie that's very critical of American interventionalism and very critical mm-hmm. of colonialism. And it's definitely a movie about how the U.S. arms dictators around the world. Mm-hmm. Our hands are not clean. I think the fact that it's set in South America is very clear. I will say that at a certain point, you definitely are in this film, you definitely are watching a number of American characters just mow down wave upon wave of South American characters. So
yeah, a lot. Yeah. I mean...
The optics of that are not wonderful, I think. although that does sort of feel like standard operating procedure for a Hollywood action movie, unfortunately. I think that this is a movie that is at least partially indebted to 80s action films, at least in its kind of gung-ho group of characters thrown into a country that's under a dictator, and I mean, there's a little bit of Predator in it, you know.
Yeah, there totally is. I didn't think about that. No, you're right, though.
Yeah. So you might just be kind of inheriting that. The optics of it are a little like, at a certain point, you're like, when you're 2.5 hours into this thing, you're like, wow, they have really killed a lot of South Americans in this movie, haven't
they? It is a long movie.
It is, but it doesn't feel that long, honestly. It moves. It definitely moves, you know?
It does move. And honestly, a lot of the stuff that I would say, you know, like, that I would nitpick about it or criticize is stuff that's kind of, like you were saying, endemic to this type of movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big CGI set piece, the overstuffed running time, the hordes of South American people being mowed down. That's all part of the genre, I think.
It is. It's also, I just think the film is genuinely hilarious in a lot of spots, and
it's pretty funny.
I also think it's kind of touching in spots, honestly. I was a little disarmed by a few moments in this film. I think that Gunn has a kind of strange talent. He has the ability to hit the sweet spot between glib, like nearly nihilistic irreverence, and genuine affection for his characters. You know, there's this climactic moment in the movie, and I will be very, very vague about this and not specific at all. But
okay.
a character who we've been following the whole time uses their powers to the greatest extent that we've seen so far, kind of saves the day in some respects. And during that moment, Gunn cross cuts to a flashback of a kind of formative moment from that character's life. And I found it. I found myself getting a little choked up, which is kind of remarkable.
Wow.
For this kind of movie. I just think he understands these characters are ridiculous in that they are mostly D-list villains from the DC universe. But at the same time, he also is kind of interested in them as traumatized people, you know?
Yeah. I think I know which character you mean, and there are a few standout characters in kind of the core squad, and that character is one of them. Yeah, like, that was something that I noticed in this film, too, is that there is, like, at first, you know, it's purely comedic, you know, they're cannon fodder, and there is a whole thing in the film where kind of the guys are having a dick-measuring contest the whole time. I think that overinflated male egos are also very much lampooned in this movie. But, yeah, after a certain point, it reaches a point where, organically, like, they don't force it. They don't, there's not like a flashing sign that says, this is when they all learn to like each other.
Right.
It just happens organically over the course of the movie. And that's something that I think Gunn is really good at. You know, the Guardians films, the kind of group dynamic of that is a big selling point on those films too.
I actually think that this improves on Guardians in the respect that you're talking about, to be honest, because I think that one of the things that I ended up feeling about the first Guardians of the Galaxy film was that they kind of just became friends at a certain point. It almost felt like that was a development that happened off screen, you know, we were just supposed to accept. One minute they were sort of uneasy partners, and then the next minute they are accepting each other as the surrogate family. I think this movie kind of earns it a little bit more, to be honest.
I think so too. Yeah, it's hard to kind of say the exact moment when it happened, like I said, but by the end of it, it does kind of have genuine heart, which for a movie that is so irreverent is kind of an impressive trick to pull off, honestly. And, you know, while we're on the subject of James Gunn's strengths, one more thing is, you know, when you were talking about him kind of flexing on the previous Suicide Squad film, the biggest way that he does that here, I think, is in needle drops. He is definitely showing David Ayer how needle drops are done in this film.
And to Ayer's defense, it is widely understood that the version of that movie that he was making is not the version we necessarily saw in theaters. What happened was they released this trailer that was very Guardians of the Galaxy for the first Suicide Squad that was very heavy on needle drops and had this kind of rock and roll energy to it. And people loved that trailer, and DC supposedly said, can you make the movie more like that? And I think that's why it, in his version of the movie, which is I think is a total fucking mess, but in his version of the movie, you will get like characters being introduced and then reintroduced two more times, you know? It's just like, yeah, the movie almost feels cut around its song cues. So I think that you're right, though, that that Gunn knows how to actually do that and how to do it right. And there are a lot of really, this is definitely, I think people are going to like the soundtrack to this film, I think, and be searching for songs.
I think so, too.
I found myself searching for a couple songs after this movie was over. Like, sometimes when I'm in a screening, I'll sort of write down lyrics just so I can find a song afterwards, you know?
I do that too.
Oh yeah, there we go. Yep. So I think that as a kind of extension of his occasional music video approach to comic book cinema, I think it works really well in that respect too.
Yeah, and the AM gold that you loved from the Guardians movies does show up a little bit in here. I mean, I think overall, like, to go back to something we were talking about up top, I think overall a lot of superhero cinema, Marvel and DC, has become really preoccupied with this idea of being a superhero being this responsibility, this heavy responsibility that's laden with all this weight, and that all these characters are kind of tortured by it. And this movie just doesn't even entertain that idea at all. First of all, because they're super villains, and so it's a slightly different framing. But I think that if you find superhero movies, recent ones, to be altogether too serious, you're going to like this movie a lot. That's all we've got for you this week. Old and The Green Knight are in theaters now, and The Suicide Squad hits theaters and HBO Max next Friday. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to Film Club wherever you get your podcasts.
This week's episode of Film Club was hosted by me, Alex Dowd, and by Katie Reif. It was edited and mixed by Zach Goldsboro, and our motion graphics designer is Julie Mullins. Stay tuned next week when we'll have a brand new episode. Thanks, folks.
Bye.